Welcome to the 1996 Boyer Lectures. And before I introduce the 1996 Boyer Lecturer, let's talk a little bit about Boyer, because there's no doubt that as soon as you name a lecture in honour of somebody, we all immediately forget who that person was. Well, Sir Richard Boyer was a chairman of the ABC back in the glory days when there was lots of money and lots of hope, and he had a particular interest in the spoken word. And I've no doubt he'd have a particular interest in the spoken words of Pierre Ryckmans, that internationally renowned novelist, scholar, sinologist, artist and calligrapher, who uses the pen name, the pseudonym, Simon Lays. I first became aware of Simon Lays when, in the 70s, I read a remarkable book called Chinese Shadows. It infuriated most of the Western sinologists, who I'm afraid often doubled as apologists for the regime. And I was astonished and delighted to discover that Simon Lays, who was being raved about in every distinguished journal around the planet, was living in Australia, where he was thinly disguised as Pierre Ryckmans, a notoriously reclusive academic. Now, Ryckmans was born in Belgium in 1935. He became interested in China 20 years later, when he was a first-year law student at the University of Louvain and was invited to visit the mainland. After finishing his law degree, he spent some years training in Chinese language and literature in Taiwan and then worked on his doctorate on art. After completing the doctorate, he moved to Hong Kong to do further research. Then, fortuitously, Australia called and he was offered a job teaching Chinese literature at the Australian National University. It was an out-of-the-blue offer, but Pierre likes that sort of thing. He believes in the importance of chance happenings, what he calls the miraculous banal, in both life and scholarship. Controversy followed Pierre to the University of Sydney in 1988, when he took up the chair of Chinese studies, and he's recently retired to write full-time. Now, the lectures you're about to hear are a personal journey. They're about Pierre's life as a writer and as a teacher, and they explore his notion of culture, which he describes as the true and unique signature of man. Now, along the way, you'll get some insight into some very interesting questions. For example, why is good literature essentially useless? Why was it wise for an ancient Greek philosopher to advise his students not to learn reading? And most importantly, and this is a question I know that you've all been terribly concerned about for most of your lives, how can we know that fish are happy? Let me now introduce you to the supple, subtle mind of the 1996 Boyer Lecturer, Pierre Ryckmans.
The other day, I paid a visit to an old friend who is a philosopher. I found him in his garden, pruning his roses. I could not resist making the observation that this seemed a most befitting occupation for a philosopher. But my remark made him laugh. He was quick to remind me that a number of famous philosophers had, in fact, shown a strong allergy to such earthy hobbies. In our own time, for instance, think of Jean-Paul Sartre. The protagonist of his novel, Nausea, has a sudden intuition of the fundamental absurdity of existence in a public garden as he sees an old tree root grotesquely shaped. And the experience is of such intensity that it makes him literally vomit. By the same token, one might even wonder if modern existentialist philosophers would not need to take seasickness pills before undertaking any gardening. Still, I do believe that my naive observation did, in a way, hit upon a deeper truth. It was not meant to be a facile reference to Voltaire's well-known precept, expressed at the conclusion of Candide. The ultimate secret of wisdom is to cultivate one's own garden. No, what I had in mind was something even more basic. It was simply the instinctive and universal awareness that the quest of the philosopher is as ancient and as essential to the human endeavor as the primeval occupation of the peasant. John Henry Newman's magnificent statement on spiritual development, "Growth is the only evidence of life," might as well have been issued by an old farmer. Since the dawn of civilization, actually, since Neolithic times, when prehistoric man first began to settle down, to sow, to plant and to harvest, culture has sustained and defined us. And it is not by chance that we use the same word when we speak both of cultivating our gardens and of cultivating our minds. Indeed, culture is the true and unique signature of man. A prehistoric cave that presents material evidence of ancient occupation may have been inhabited by pithecanthropes or other ape-like creatures, infinitely remote from us. Yet, one single picture engraved or painted on its wall, however sketchy, rough, faint and faded, at once tells us a different story. A long time ago, man was here, or ancestor, or brother. His individual presence signaled across a chasm of 10 or 20 millennia is as immediate, unmistakable, and overwhelming as that of Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. Culture is the very means through which we realize the fullness of our humanity. Inasmuch as we are human, we are all producers and consumers of culture. We all experience culture in diverse forms. In these talks, I wish simply to draw from my own personal experience. I was a teacher, I am a writer, and I shall therefore offer some reflections on a series of topics, which I would call respectively learning, reading, writing, going abroad and staying home. Part one is learning. In the Confessions of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, there is a passage where Rousseau is recalling how he was once summoned to appear before the council of his local church, which suspected him of heresy. Since the council was comprised of country bumpkins, Rousseau, who was already famous throughout Europe for his inspired and passionate eloquence, had good reason to feel complete confidence regarding the outcome of the confrontation. Things, however, turned out quite differently. To his own astonishment and dismay, once in front of his Philistine judges, he found himself virtually speechless. Unable to improvise any effective reply to their bigoted accusations, he eventually had to leave the meeting, humiliated, confused and defeated. Later on, walking alone in the night on the long way home, he pondered over his disastrous performance, replaying in his mind the proceedings of the day. But now, suddenly the inspiration that had failed him earlier in the day returned with cruel vengeance. A flow of brilliant ideas surged in his mind. He thought of all the irrefutable arguments and witty retorts which would have so easily confounded his opponents. But the opportunity was lost forever. He cried with frustration and beat his own head with his fist. Have you ever had a similar experience? I suspect that many people must have said to themselves, "Oh yes, how well I know that feeling." Life throws many challenges at us, and when we fail to live up to them, they leave burning memories of humiliation and defeat, and an intense desire to be granted the impossible chance to reenact the test in which we disgraced ourselves. Still, in our frustration, we may perhaps derive some melancholy comfort from the thought that, in this respect at least, we have something in common with a genius. In my own case, I vividly remember an incident which occurred many years ago. You may find it small and trivial, and I myself still remain puzzled by a sense of disproportion between what seemed the trifling nature of the actual episode and the imprint it left on my memory. Perhaps it is only now, as I am, in a certain way, reenacting this ancient test which I so miserably failed, that I come to measure its full import and begin to understand its original meaning. It was during a scholarly conference organized in one of our leading universities. A guest speaker had been invited from abroad to address the conference. He was an elderly scholar, a rather frail and refined old gentleman, who spoke with erudition and feeling on the subject of Chinese literary painting, a topic that had occupied him for his entire life. When the old professor finished his talk, a young local academic stood up and, instead of addressing questions to the lecturer, launched himself into a lengthy and passionate denunciation of the lecture that had just been delivered. In brief, his argument was that to attach such an exclusive value and importance to what China's feudal oppressors had deemed to be superior art merely reflected the speaker's narrow bourgeois elitism, whereas the true art of China, which was produced by the broad working masses, was being systematically ignored or dismissed by the academic mandarins, etc., etc. The violence of the attack took the old gentleman by surprise, but he remained silent and impassive. The chairman of that particular session, a rather shy and ineffectual man, was visibly shaken and appeared totally unable to resume control of the proceedings. One could feel widespread embarrassment and discomfort among the public. Unfortunately, the usual reaction of decent people who are being confronted with a gross indecency is to pretend studiously that nothing happened. A younger segment of the audience, however, had obviously come in the expectation of watching the fireworks of their local hero. His show was geared towards them, and they cheered loudly. I was suddenly reminded of a similar scene in a novel by Saul Bellow. Bellow's image has remained engraved on my mind. In his story, a young mob was compared to a certain species of big apes, baboons, I seem to remember. Whenever a trespasser ventures into their forest, the baboons frantically defecate in each other's hands and bombard the hapless visitor with their own excrement. The young academic talked nearly as long as the original speaker, interrupted only by the applause of his supporters. When he concluded at long last, there was no more time for discussion, and the entire session was hastily brought to an end. For all its aggressive energy, the improvised speech by the spokesman for the baboons was in itself quite banal. It merely rehashed some slogans which, for a time, the Chinese Cultural Revolution had made fashionable among smart academics in our universities. Its actual argumentation was trite and could easily have been disposed of. After all, to state that an artist, or an art historian for that matter, is a bourgeois, or a proletarian, or an aristocrat, is exactly as pertinent and as informative, no more, no less, as to observe that he has red hair or flat feet. No. The truly disturbing aspect of his intervention did not reside in what he said, but in the reaction of the audience, or rather, in the lack of reaction from the audience. This absence of reaction, in turn, reflected something ominous about the state of the university and about ourselves as academics. It became suddenly evident to me that most of us were dead and had been dead for many years already, and the stench made you gasp for air. For the larger part, the audience was composed of scholars who, being educated and courteous, naturally deplored the poor manners displayed by their young colleague. But as to the content of his intervention, even though some of them might have had reservations about what he said, all, apparently, believed that, in a so-called intellectual debate, every opinion should be granted a fair hearing. None of them, it seemed, and this is what truly frightened me, perceived that what they had just heard was not one opinion among many, but a statement which, if validly issued, certified the fully consummated demise of the university. Indeed, what the young academic had proclaimed, without provoking any challenge, was the impossibility and intellectual illegitimacy of all value judgments. From his perspective, value judgments were necessarily a form of cultural arrogance. Any attempt to assess objective qualities was doomed to remain a mere expression of social prejudice. But such a view, in turn, must reduce all scholarly endeavor to a hollow comedy. And in this regard, I am irresistibly reminded of an old cartoon by Michael Lunig portraying a trendy modern cleric. The caption read, "Reverend so-and-so, who does not believe in God, but needs the job." For, clearly, to deny the existence of objective values is to deprive the university of its spiritual means of operation. Values are the prerequisite of any inquiry into art, letters, and the humanities. For example, how can you study literature without passing literary judgment and making reference to literary quality? Without having recourse to aesthetic appreciation, what enables you to assess that Jane Austen truly pertains to your discipline, but not Barbara Cartland? Is such a discrimination truly a mere expression of subjectivity and intellectual arrogance? If, in the name of a spurious scientific objectivity, every bit of printed matter has an equal right to call upon the literary scholar's attention, on what basis should he exclude from his scrutiny lawnmower handbooks and Superman comics? The actual fact is that, nowadays, precisely he does not exclude them from his study. In these areas, the most grotesque imagination is always overtaken by stark reality. And I should not be surprised if I were to learn that right now, in the English literature departments of our vanguard universities, duly renamed Departments of Human Communications and Sociocultural Deconstruction, there are earnest candidates for the doctoral degree, hard at work, deconstructing the telephone directory. A true university is, and has always been, anchored in values. Deprived of this holding ground, it can only drift at the caprice of all the winds and currents of fashion, and in the end, is doomed to founder in the shallows of farce and incoherence. In a private letter, posthumously published, Hannah Arendt provided a striking insight on the relation between truth and thought that could provide an illuminating paradigm for the dependence of any scholarly investigation upon a pre-existing concept of values. Arendt wrote, I quote, "The chief fallacy is to believe that truth is a result which comes at the end of a thought process. Truth, on the contrary, is always the beginning of thought. Thinking starts after an experience of truth has struck home, so to speak. The difference between philosophers and other people is that the former refuse to let go, but not that they are the only receptacles of truth. Truth, in other words, is not in thought, but it is the condition for the possibility of thinking. It is both beginning and a priori. The view that truth is not a conclusion, but a premise, and the very condition for any intellectual inquiry, is important and profound, but not as new as Arendt thought. 2,300 years ago, the great Chinese philosopher Zhuangzi expressed a similar idea in one of his rich and enigmatic parables, which could be paraphrased in English as follows. Zhuangzi and his friend, the logician Huizi, were taking a stroll on the bridge over the river Hao. It was a beautiful day, and they stopped for a moment to watch the little fish below. Zhuangzi said, "Look at the fish. How free and easy they swim. That is their happiness." But Huizi immediately objected. "You are not a fish. Whence do you know that the fish are happy?" "You are not me," replied Zhuangzi. "How can you possibly know that I do not know if the fish are happy?" Huizi said, "We'll grant that I am not you, and therefore cannot know what you know. But you must grant that you are not a fish, and therefore cannot know whether the fish are happy or not." Zhuangzi replied, "Let us return to the original question. When you ask me, whence do you know that the fish are happy, your very question showed that you knew that I knew. Still, if you insist on asking whence I know, I will tell you. I know it from this bridge." To make a minute exegesis of such a piece would ruin it. It would be as brutish as pulling off the wings of a butterfly. Still, I merely wish to underline one point. Huizi's attitude represents the fallacy of a certain cleverness. With his abstract logic, he attempts to erode Zhuangzi's living grasp of reality. But Zhuangzi, in turn, develops his unanswerable riposte in two movements, on two different levels. In the first move, he shows Huizi that he can beat him at his own game, conjuring logic with logic. Indeed, on a strictly formal level, a question of the type, "Whence do you know?" does not put your knowledge into question. It takes it for granted and merely queries the starting point of your inference. But Zhuangzi does not stop there. To win a sterile contest of wits is unsatisfying. In his final move, with a pun, he breaks free from the fetters of empty intellectual games and enters the realm of reality, which in the end alone matters. Borrowing Huizi's original word, whence, he transforms its meaning. Whereas Huizi had used it in the abstract sense of logical deduction, Zhuangzi now takes it in its literal sense, from which point in space, and he answers it literally. But the literal answer proves also to be the most profound, more profound even than the truth. For any truth can only be about reality, whereas here we reach what truth is about, reality itself, which is irrefutable. I know it from this bridge. Here, one is reminded of Samuel Johnson's powerful retort to an interlocutor who had invoked Berkeley's idealism, questioning the reality of reality. Without a word, Johnson vigorously kicked a rock of good size that was lying on the ground. Looking from the bridge, to know that the fish are happy is ultimately an act of faith. The saying, to see is to believe, must be reversed. To believe is to see. He who believes in nothing sees nothing. The trap of seeing through things was best exposed by C.S. Lewis at the conclusion of his memorable essay in Defense of Values, The Abolition of Man. I quote, "The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent, because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? It is no use trying to see through first principles. If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see."
The voice of the 1996 Boyer lecturer, Pierre Rickmans, who has certainly sorted out the philosophical problem of the happiness of fish. Pierre is the author of 15 books, including Chinese Shadows, the novel The Death of Napoleon, and a forthcoming translation of The Analects of Confucius. Next week, Pierre continues his thoughts about learning and comes to the question of reading. He asks the question, is there any book that has actually affected your life? The Boyer Lectures are produced by Jan Ryan, with technical production by John Diamond.